Good morning and welcome to this month's Hancock Whitney Asset Management Economic Update Call. The information and opinions expressed on this call are those of the individuals who made the statement and do not necessarily reflect the policies, views, opinions, and positions of Hancock Whitney Bank. Hancock Whitney makes no representations as to the accuracy, completeness, timeliness, suitability, or validity of any information presented. This information is in general in nature and is provided for educational purposes only. Information provided and statements made should not be relied on or interpreted as accounting, financial planning, investment, legal, or tax advice. Hancock Whitney Bank encourages you to consult a professional for advice applicable to your specific situation. If you have any questions, please email them to me, david.lundgren@hancockwhitney.com. On this morning's call, we have investment directors Richard Chauvin, Martin Serrera, and Jeff Tangus, Chief Investment Strategist Paul Teton, and myself, Chief Investment Officer David Lundgren, who will be serving as the moderator. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Dave.
So there's been a fair amount of back and forth between the U.S. and China over the last couple of weeks. That's introduced a fair amount of volatility in the markets. There was even some news over the weekend. So if you could, for starters, maybe just recap the most recent turn in negotiations.
I sure will, Dave. So I'm going to go back to late July, very briefly. We may remember that the U.S. trade team went to Beijing and returned, and in a conversation with President Trump, accused China of slow-walking the talks. So Trump promptly added a 10% tariff on the rest of the $300 billion in Chinese imports that he had not previously tariffed. Many of these are consumer goods, which had been spared in the first round. To this, China retaliated with tariffs on U.S. autos and parts totaling about $75 billion and threatened other non-tariff measures, which have not been specified. However, one of the actions we've seen occur is that they allowed the yuan, their currency, to weaken, which makes U.S. goods more expensive in China and harms U.S.'s export competitiveness. Other measures China may take, may include harassing U.S. companies housed there, doing business there, restricting access to the rare earth elements that China has almost a monopoly over, and tightening regulations on U.S. financial companies. So after that, President Trump then responded by increasing the tariff rate to 30% from the previous 25% on the original batch of imports from China, and then went to 15% tariff from 10% on the latest group of goods he had previously just announced a tariff on. He was later convinced by his advisors to implement the new tariffs in stages rather than all at once, in order to reduce the negative impact on U.S. consumers. This 15% tariff actually became effective Sunday, September 1st, but that was only for a portion of the $300 billion in goods, estimated $110 billion worth of the $300 billion. These include such things as apparel, furniture, and toys from China. The rest of the goods in that batch will be hit, if that schedule holds, on December 15th. And then the original batch of goods, the $250 billion, will see a tariff increase to 30% on October 1st. So a lot of dates mentioned there showing that staged impact. So the next step was China threatened more retaliation, but last week a spokesperson stated they prefer not to do it at this time. They're going to hold off any retaliation this time. They're seeking a calmer environment to hold some talks in September. Phone conversations may have been held last week. There's not been any real specific statement about those phone calls, and no specifics were reported. Formal talks are scheduled, or actually supposed to happen in Washington this month, but no date has been disclosed. And then this weekend, over the Labor Day weekend, it was reported that there's been a lack of agreement on what on the specifics about the September meeting, and they have not been scheduled because of two reasons. The American team wants to set specific parameters for the talks, which apparently is a point of contention, and China wants the U.S. to delay any new tariffs. Obviously, this weekend, President Trump doubled down and implemented them anyway on Sunday. So China's going to says they're going to file a complaint with the World Trade Organization under the dispute settlement process of the WTO. And Trump, sort of amazingly, expressed frustration that the talks haven't brought the two sides closer together, stating that if he cannot deliver a better economic arrangement with China, then, quote, let's not do business together, close quote. So that's where we are today, Dave.
And I guess along those lines, one of the tweets, I think it might have been last week or the week before, President Trump tweeted out that all U.S. companies should begin planning to leave China. Is this really a serious threat? And I can only imagine what the ramifications would be if that were to occur. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, here's my thoughts on it. I think he stated to remind business leaders and obviously the media that he has authority to force this under an existing law, though he would need to call a national emergency over the issue first, which he has not done. So it was also, I think it was also done to reinforce the view that he sees China as a national security issue, not just a trade war or a trade dispute. I do not think he would actually impose the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977, which is what he was referring to without stating so, but he may feel that he has a bully pulpit that may be effective enough to convince corporate CEOs to take this threat of China more seriously. But if he actually did take action under this law, depending on how quickly he would enforce it, it would be very disruptive to the existing supply chains, as these are very intricately planned and require a lot of advanced planning to build. I think this could lead to a strong negative market reaction if he was to do this, and probably a recession, which would make his reelection chances unlikely, since unemployment would seemingly increase under those conditions. And it's been shown by history that employment levels are highly correlated with any incumbent president's ability to get reelected.
Okay. You know, China's obviously in serious negotiations with the United States, but they have another issue that they're dealing with, and that's the protests in Hong Kong. We talked about it last month a little bit. How does that play into the trade negotiations, if at all?
Well, I think it could. The situation, and I monitored it over the weekend, as I'm sure many of us did, where China may feel compelled to respond to stop it at some point. Don't know when that point may be. To date, the stronger police responses seem only to have increased the motivation of the protesters to further escalate beyond just peaceful protest. I mean, there have been reports of Molotov cocktails and bricks and all those types of things being thrown. Mainland China officials may eventually have to take more direct action if Hong Kong cannot quell these protests themselves. I think we have to remember that Chinese officials on the mainland really cannot tolerate any threat to their authority or to the Communist Party's control and rule over Hong Kong. I think they would see this as an existential threat to their rule of the country. If they do act, and it seems like that's where we're headed, but I can't predict when. If they do act, there's likely to be a plausible, it's likely to be plausible that there'll be international condemnation of China's unwillingness to listen to the demands of the Hong Kong citizens who've been calling for more democracy. It's quite plausible that the U.S. administration would escalate this situation by placing sanctions on China and Chinese officials should China respond with force to stop these protests. And then this would no longer be just a trade dispute. It's doubtful that any kind of trade deal would be possible for a long time if such a thing were to happen.
Okay. And last question on China. I know that we've kind of been discussing the longer this plays out, the less likely that there's a deal before the election. Is that still sort of your base case, that no deal? And maybe just talk about how the election plays into how okay. this plays out.
Sure thing. So based on all the actions of Trump and his statements, and we've documented those quite a bit in these calls and in print, I now think a deal before the election is really unlikely. It's pretty clear that a weak deal to Trump is not palatable, and I think that's become more accepted in consensus thinking. And it would be a pretty big negative for his campaign that could be used against him, that he caused all this economic turmoil and market turmoil and got nothing of substance from it. A strong deal is really not likely, I think, because China appears intent on waiting Trump's term out, looking or hoping for a different opponent. China has shown that their industrial policy, which, as we've discussed, involves technology transfers, intellectual property theft, and maintaining this unfair business environment where they subsidize state-owned enterprises, is not something they are willing to just give up, and certainly not to a president that's likely to be out in less than 2 years. So I think a deal is unlikely.
Okay. Thanks, Richard. And let's just kind of switch gears, if you could. A lot of headlines really the last week regarding Brexit. It's becoming, in my opinion, at least if you agree, more and more likely that a hard Brexit is going to occur at the upcoming deadline, which I think is October 31st. Is that right?
That is correct, Dave. And I do agree with your opinion. Yeah, sure will. So one of the things that happened last week that was pretty significant was Prime Minister Boris Johnson did request from Queen Elizabeth that she suspend Parliament, or that she give him permission to suspend Parliament, and she did do so. So that the plan is he's going to suspend Parliament between mid-September and mid-October. And this was pretty outrageous in the view of many on the side that says we don't want to have a no-deal Brexit. It's actually outrageous to many, I think even a broader group of people than that, because it limits the opportunity for negotiation in Parliament about how to deal with this issue, which they've struggled with for, 3 years now. So the Brexit team, if this parliamentary suspension occurs, the Brexit team is still planning to meet with the EU negotiators over the Brexit deal twice a week during September to try to break the impasse that's existed for a long time. But his office did state that the two parties still remain distant. There's some distance between them on a number of issues. So it seems like there's not a lot of progress been made yet. The Labour Party, the opponent party to Johnson, has said that there is a cross-party majority in Parliament to block a no-deal Brexit, which is probably one of the reasons he's wanting to suspend Parliament to prevent that from happening. However, there's some legal challenges pending to his ability to suspend Parliament. And then the latest news just coming out over the weekend is that there's a crucial vote tonight over this issue, and if Johnson loses that vote, which would mean that Parliament has agreed to prevent a no-deal Brexit, then Johnson has stated, even though he doesn't want to do it, he will call a snap election, which could, change the complexion in Parliament, and it could even cause a no-confidence vote. So a lot of things coming to a head here on the Brexit situation.
All right, great. Thank you, Richard. Paul Teaton, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
So, I normally start with a discussion about the U.S. economy, but this, based on Richard's comments regarding Brexit, maybe as a follow-up to that, let's just make the assumption that we are going to have a hard Brexit. I know we've got some pretty weak economic data coming out of Germany. Looks pretty troublesome for the EU in terms of economic growth. first of all, do you agree with that statement, and how's the rest of the data looking from the EU?
The economy, economic outlook in Europe is looking pretty worrisome. A year ago, Eurozone growth was running around 2%, maybe a little under, and has slipped to 1% rates lately in the second quarter. So pretty significant slowdown. In Germany, it's even more pronounced. They had about a minus 0.5% rate in the second quarter. And the basic dynamic there is Germany runs a trade surplus with China. And so all the tariff frictions and trade war have basically frozen capital spending plans pretty much around the world. And Germany is feeling the brunt of that. So Germany is sort of the weak link in Europe at the moment, kind of an unusual place for them, being the strongest economy in Europe. So it's a pretty red flag that things are deteriorating in Europe. The European Central Bank is meeting next week and has been pretty clear in guiding the markets to expect further interest rate cuts in their policy rate, which is now minus 40 basis points. Markets pretty much expect that to go to minus 60, and probably accompanied by a new round of quantitative easing. So we have a hard time handicapping what that would mean. The European Central Bank went through a fairly aggressive quantitative easing round in the last few years, which ended only last December, in which they acquired around $2.5 trillion of bond assets in Europe, government and corporate bonds. So one question would be, you know, what's left to buy? So they could surprise the markets and say they're going to buy stocks, for example. So we don't know that, and that would be a fairly radical move for a central bank. But anyway, we're all kind of watching what the central bank comes up with next week, all because of basically pretty alarming slow growth conditions in Europe. So that's really the dynamic that is driving world economic activity, is a slowdown in capital spending.
Well, Paul, let's talk about the U.S. a little bit because, you know, we have slowing growth, seems like just about everywhere, yet the United States seems to be hanging in there. I know we had a pretty weak manufacturing PMI number that came out right as we were starting this call. But it's really the consumer, you know, that seems to be carrying the U.S. economy. Do you think that can continue? And what would be a sign that maybe it's starting to falter a little bit?
Well, we're keeping our fingers crossed, Dave. The U.S. consumer, as you point out, is carrying the U.S. economy on its back. Household spending has been, you could call it, robust this year. And that's largely driven by full employment. Employment growth is pretty solid. It's slowed a little bit from a fairly torrid pace last year to something more modest, around 170,000 monthly gains in non-farm payrolls is the trend this year. We're going to get an update on that Friday. So the market's looking for about another 170,000 increase in non-farm payrolls. So essentially the consumer is healthy and spending, and that's really what's driving growth in the U.S. The 2% real GDP print for the second quarter was camouflaged a pretty strong growth under the hood in that inventories were liquidated. The trade deficit improved a little bit, and real final sales to domestic purchasers, sort of a core underlying growth trend in the U.S., was at 3.5%. So really pretty impressive growth apart from inventories and trade. So the thing that could be worrisome is if employment growth were to slow, that's the pillar that is driving this strong consumer behavior. So consumer confidence, we saw last week, there were sort of mixed results. The Conference Board survey was remains at a peak. The University of Michigan consumer sentiment had a setback. Kind of all in all, the conclusion is that consumer confidence is pretty high, although when you're at peak confidence, there's pretty much only one way to go. So if employment growth were to slow, if other things could happen around the world that were sort of flashpoints, Hong Kong, for example, it's not hard to see consumer confidence ebbing and resulting in slower consumption. So behind consumption, there's not much else that's growing in the U.S. economy. Housing is weak and sluggish. Capital spending, as in other places, has slowed to a crawl here, not as weak as Germany here, but definitely spending plans are on hold, and year-to-year growth in core capital goods purchases here has been trending around zero. So we think that there is a possibility that you could get a little bit of a manufacturing resurgence here with strong consumers and inventories having been liquidated in second quarter. Kind of points toward the possibility and probability that U.S. manufacturers are going to have to start to make stuff to restock the shelves. That's a pretty typical inventory cycle. So we appear set up for that. And so while our kind of base case growth forecast for the U.S. is in the 2 to 2.5% real GDP trend range for the next 6 months to a year, we're kind of thinking that the high side of that might be attainable. So it hadn't happened yet. As you pointed out, the ISM manufacturing survey came out for August at the top of this hour at the start of the call, and it's 49.5, so right on the cusp between expansion and contraction. So really a sort of middling sluggish signal from the manufacturing sector, which is not really a change. Manufacturing has been sluggish all year, and we're just kind of hoping for a rebound.
Rebound sounds good. Thank you, Paul. Jeff Angus, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
So, you know, one thing that's been in the media is this talk about an inverted yield curve, and that being a sign that the U.S. economy is headed to a recession. Talk a little bit, maybe for some of our listeners, first explain what an inverted yield curve is, and then how did it happen?
Sure, happy to. Well, in a normal state of things, as we all know, if you invest longer term, you generally would expect a higher rate of return to accommodate the uncertainty and tying up your money for longer time periods. An inverted curve is just that, when actually investing longer term gets you lower yields instead of higher yields. So consequently, when you have an inverted yield curve situation, you might earn more in a money market fund than you would in a 10-year bond. And so that's kind of the situation that we flirted with here off and on over the last month or so in the United States, especially with the U.S. Treasury yield curve. And the reason that happens is that, there are two reasons we end up in that situation. One, we're in a global economy. And as we've talked about here, the rest of the world is really very sluggish in terms of their economies. Their demand for capital is low. There's not a lot of investment going on. So consequently, rates around the world are much lower than ours here. And so we have the highest interest rates in the developed world. We're also the safest and most liquid markets in terms of bond investing. And so global investors are flooding into our markets to take advantage of our higher yields than, say, example, what they have in Europe. So that's the first thing. Capital flows around the world in a global economy, and now investors from around the world have come in and bought our longer-term bonds, essentially, and pushed longer-term interest rates lower. We've talked about kind of who controls what parts of the bond market in the past. Essentially, the Fed has a high degree of control over very short-term investments, say out to 2 years. The Fed can control that just with their Fed funds rate. Longer-term interest rates, however, are largely dictated by the markets. The Fed can influence it some, but essentially the markets and bond investors control longer-term interest rates, call it 10-year type securities. So, again, bond investors around the world have come in and bought up a lot of our longer-term bonds because of the attractive rates and forced those rates lower. So that's the first half of the reason. The second half is here at home, that with basically our economy in good shape but slowing, we see investors looking around the world at Europe and other places cutting rates, and they realize that the Federal Reserve is probably going to have to cut rates on the short end eventually. And so to get in front of that, what they do is they go out and invest longer term to lock in those higher yielding rates, even though they may earn less in the short term. In the longer run, they end up earning more because the Fed will ultimately cut short-term rates and leave them in a higher yielding position, ultimately speaking. That's the two biggest reasons, Dave.
Okay. And so you said the Fed controls, you know, 2 years and under. What does the market think the Fed's going to do, and do you agree?
Well, the market has been pretty consistent in that they believe, again, because of a slowing global economy and somewhat slowing here at the U.S., still good but slowing, that the Fed will ultimately have to cut. So as we look at the markets and the Fed funds futures, what we see is that the Fed is meeting in September, and because the European Central Bank will meet a little bit before them and likely cut pretty dramatically, the Fed at their September 18th meeting is almost certain to cut 25 basis points. The Fed likes to be methodical and predictable, so 25 basis points would be right in line with market expectations. There's also a likely 25 basis point cut between the September meeting and the end of the year. There's two other meetings left, October and December. They could do either one. That's 25 basis points. And then there's even a possibility of a third, but more than likely that comes in 2020, next year, not this year. So two cuts look likely this year with a third sometime next year.
Okay. So short maturities are headed down. Also noticed that, and I believe this is for the first time ever, that the 30-year U.S. Treasury rate dropped below 2%, and the 10-year dropped below 1.5%. So it was the first time both were under those numbers, those benchmarks. I mean, could they possibly go lower from here? I mean, we know the short end's going lower. You see the long end going lower, longer maturities going lower as well. Jeff, did we lose you?
I'm sorry. There we go. It appears global rates are headed lower. Now, we talked about Brexit, and Brexit certainly a headwind for the global economy. So that's going to help nudge interest rates around the world lower. So it is very possible, if not likely, that rates are headed lower here and around the world. I'd point out also that the last time rates were anywhere near this low, it was in 2016 when Great Britain announced, had just taken the Brexit vote, the referendum, and that news had come out. So here we are 3 years later, and a lot of the same factors are at work. So, yes, it's definitely possible that rates could head lower from here, both on the short and the long end.
Okay. Appreciate it, Jeff. Let's move on to Martin for a little discussion about the stock market. Good morning, Martin. Martin? Sorry.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
Good. So, I know the S&P 500 was down a little bit more than 2% for the month, and it's flat for the quarter. We're still having a good year. But it's interesting, as I talk to customers and just friends, it sure does feel like the market is doing much worse than that. Any color on why that is?
Yeah, Dave, that's an excellent observation. The market definitely, the mood of equity investors is definitely punk right now. And there's a couple of things going on that are weighing on investors' moods, and partly due to all the things that Paul and Richard and Jeff have already talked about this morning. Equity market volatility has been on the rise over the last couple of months. Really, since late 2017, volatility is picking up, including a couple of huge spikes late last year and early this year. With the exception of the slowdown in 2015 and early 2016, equity market volatility since the economic crisis has been very low. And so this new pickup in volatility is sort of a new experience for investors, or it's a reflection from a long time ago. And getting whipsawed so much lately is getting investors quite nervous. And so, yeah, to that, talk about recessions and inverted yield curves and trade wars and global turmoil and anxiety is definitely on the rise. And one more thing, equity markets haven't really been strong for a year and a half, a solid year and a half. The market is up double digits so far this year, but that came on the heels of a big sell-off at the end of last year. So to your point, it does feel much worse than that.
Okay. And then, we've kind of focused on U.S. markets. What about other markets internationally?
The pattern has been mostly the same turning points, give or take a few weeks or a month or so, the same uptick in volatility. Other markets, though, have been underperforming large cap U.S. stocks, and not just foreign markets, but other indexes in the U.S. like small cap stocks. So investors with what we would consider prudently diversified portfolios are not getting the full benefit of that double digit return in 2019, and that's also contributing to the low level of confidence as we move into the latter part of this year.
Okay. So with this, the recent pullback, what sort of impact on valuations, if any? Market looking cheap, expensive, somewhere?
That question, I think, really deserves the answer that, you hate to give, but which is that depends. By some measures, like current and near-term PE ratios, valuations are elevated but not extremely high. Certainly earnings growth has leveled off in 2019 and prices have risen. So, with the E being flat and the P going up, the ratio has expanded. But at 18 times earnings in a low inflation environment, it's not really a case where we could say things are completely out of whack. Other measures of valuation, like price-to-sales ratio on the S&P 500, are a bit more elevated. Price-to-sales is over 2. It's off slightly from recent peaks, but at 2x sales, that level hasn't really been exceeded except in the late 1990s and early 2000s.
Okay, great. Last question. Rest of the year, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, we're frankly pretty cautious right now. The headlines are dominated, of course, by bad news, and considering the fact that the S&P 500 hasn't advanced much since late 2017, and we've experienced a few sharp pullbacks, there is some probability that markets have already priced in the malaise that we're feeling right now. As you and Paul discussed earlier, the consumer has been a very bright spot, which, if current wage growth and spending trends hold, should keep the U.S. out of recession. But also, as Paul pointed out earlier, there are things that we're very wary about and paying close attention to: global economic slowdown, trade wars, unrest in Hong Kong, just to name a few. And, of course, the inverted yield curve, which is getting so much press, as you and Jeff talked about, is certainly not a sign of robust economic activity. Sure. Overall, we expect equity markets to continue to experience higher levels of volatility, but not move in a significant direction one way or another in the near future.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you, Martin. Thank you, everyone, for joining us this morning. Please join us next month when we'll have our call on October 1st. Thank you.